You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, all you wiretappers out there. I'm here in the Gangland Wire studio. We've got our good friend and researcher and co-host, Camellius Robinson, on the Skype line, and we are going to talk about the Irishman. The Irishman is the biggest topic going right now, isn't it, Cam?
Man, they got millions and millions on Netflix. Hell of a good movie, I'll say that.
Yeah, it is. A little bit long, but we're going to discuss that, folks. You know? And before we start this, now don't forget, hit me up for a buck or two to buy me a cup of coffee or a shot in a beer. I've gotten a few shots in the beer here. I've gotten a few shots and beers here lately, so keep it going. Ted Beckett, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. I see that this guy is a real mob fan. He's from Des Moines, Iowa, West Des Moines, Iowa. He once was in New York when the last Gotti trial was in play and going, and he watched Sammy Gravano testify for 2 days. Now, that would be quite a field trip, wouldn't it?
Damn. That's the time to be there if you're going to see something.
So this dude, he even was in Kansas City once. And he just he doesn't like follow this around. It was just a happenstance. And one of our local mob underlings, Willie Camisano Jr., was here on trial. And I'm not sure what that trial was, because he said Benny Binion, a casino owner from Las Vegas, happened to testify while he was there. So I think it was probably Willie Jr. used to go out and gamble in Las Vegas on golf games. He's a pretty good golfer, and I'll bet it was something to do with that, but I can't really remember what the deal was. So he is a real mob fan. Let's see who else we got here. We got John DeSoto. He's from Kansas City, made a nice donation. I just put some rewards in the mail for him today, John, so you'll probably have those time I got them. Ellen Myers here, she just made a nice donation, sent her a movie. We got Ryan Stevens. Again, Ryan Stevens is a repeat offender here lately. I think he's buying Christmas presents, what he's doing with his... And I had several of those. You know, I did the film festival, and a lot of people were buying extra copies of Brothers Against Brothers because it's a nice time to have something up for sale for Christmas.
That's right.
And so, I'm getting a lot of hits on, a lot of play on Amazon Prime since it's up there on Prime. Now, folks, I'd rather you'd rent it for $1.99. I don't get much off that Prime thing. They kind of rake me over the coals on that. But either way it goes, just do whatever you can and watch the movie, because I think it's a good movie. And I'm getting a lot of, last time I looked, I had 7 5-star reviews, and that was several days ago. It's, you know, Cam, I have to stay away from that, because all of a sudden I'll start looking for another review, you know, every 5 minutes, or trying to find out how many people are doing something every 2 or 3 minutes, and it'll drive me crazy. So I just intentionally don't even look at it. And so
That's right.
I probably have a few more reviews by now, I hope, because it is I don't know. I've had everybody's told me they liked the movie. And so.
Well, it's exciting. It was exciting being in a room full of people watching your movie, and it was a hell of a good thing. I enjoyed getting to watch it come together. It was a hell of an effort.
Yeah, and you were a no small part of that effort to help me with that script, because it's I need those writing skills. I'm not the greatest writer in the world, so Cam helped me a lot, and he came up with a couple of nice little tidbits, like when you set out to kill one brother, you better be ready to kill them all. And Nick Savella was more Machiavelli than Mussolini. Now, that's gold there, man. That was some great stuff there. So, Cam, I really appreciate your help with that. So we're gonna talk. We'll probably be a lot of speculation. You guys know, you know me well enough by now, you know Cam, we're not big on speculation. But, you know, this whole movie, The Irishman, you know, there was a whole lot of speculation in that. I read that book, and it was really well written. I will say that. It was engaging.
I remember when it came out.
It was engaging.
I remember when it came out.
So,
my wife was working at Barnes & Noble, and I would go see her at work, and I would sit there, read it when it first came out. I didn't know what the hell that meant, paint houses. Apparently, not too many other people did either.
Yeah, I never heard that before either. I don't know. Maybe it's a Detroit thing or a Teamsters thing. I don't know. Cam's Cam's cracking himself up. Don't start laughing. You're taking a drink there, Cam.
Right.
So, you know, I guess he was like, you know, what got me, and I don't really remember exactly from the book, I should, but he was kind of like the Forrest Gump of the mafia in the 1960s and 70s. Anytime something big happened, he happened to be there. And you know, I could put up with a lot of that, but and he did know Hoffa. There's no doubt about it. He was a high-level teamster. He did know Russell Bufalino. You know, a little side story on Russell Bufalino. I had a prison guard in here from Leavenworth the other day, and Bufalino was in prison there for a while. And he, when he'd come to the commissary, this guy was working around there, and he said one time Bufalino was with some of his underlings and little protectors. He said it's just like in the movies. When these older guys are in prison, they've got some younger guys around them all the time to make sure nobody messes with them. And he and his little entourage were down there, and he said, "Hey, Mr. Bufalino," he said, "what'd you do with Hoffa's body?" And this was before this was several years ago. He said, "What'd you do with Hoffa's body?" Because it was always suspected he had a piece of it. And one of the other guys, he just kind of ignored him and gave him a look. And one of the other guys said, "You can't talk to Mr. Bufalino like that." Prison guard said, "Oh, yeah." So there's a little side story on Russell Bufalino and Jimmy Hoffa and that kind of thing. So I don't know. What jumped out at you? The one thing that, because I'm a Chicago guy, you know, I've really done a lot on Chicago and a lot on Alan Dorfman because he's involved in the skim. That one jumped out at me. What jumped out at you?
I mean, delivering in the book, he delivered the rifles to Lee Harvey Oswald, which I think was kind of a stretch because we know where those rifles came from.
Yeah, they tracked that through the mail, man.
Right. I think he delivered weapons for the Bay of Pigs, which was kind of a stretch.
Yeah.
They in the movie, he drives to Chicago on Hoffa's orders to go help a character who is Joey Glimko, push taxi cabs into the river. Now, Chicago in the 50s and into the 60s had quite a few guys who were more than capable of pushing taxi cabs into the river and blowing them up. I don't know if they would need to bring in some random Irish guy from Philadelphia to help him as muscle in Chicago. I thought that was kind of, I don't know why they'd need to import a guy just because Hoffa wanted him to. Joey Glimko was a hell of a powerful guy.
Yeah.
He was, you know, we don't see him much, but Joey Glimko ran the labor in Chicago. He spoke pretty much for the outfit, and he was their labor capo. It just seemed kind of odd they would just ship in a guy for muscle in Chicago at the time.
Really? You know, and in Chicago, that again, that Alan Dorfman thing. I mean, I know they did. Somebody did send him a message back then. Somebody did send him a message, but I mean, he was a teamster, but he was like right next to Joey Lombardo, and
it would have been Chicago.
In Chicago, they would not have farmed that out to some random teamster dude like that. They would have been the only ones that would have done that, and somebody else would have done it for some other reason. They would have wanted to know why, and they would have had to approve of it, and they still probably would not allow him, even if Hoffa said, you know, you need to scare this guy, or so Tony Pro or somebody said, you know, you need to scare this guy a little bit and shake him up, but they would have done it themselves.
Yeah, they wouldn't have asked some mob boss from northeastern Pennsylvania if they could send a guy from Philadelphia to help him out.
Really?
The Joey Gallo hit kind of bothered me. There's enough details known on Joey Gallo, and a cop named Joe Coffey, who's on a lot of the mob shows, had said they were pretty sure who did the Joey Gallo hit. When Joey Gallo and his wife and everybody went out, they really had seen Don Rickles that night. That was true in the movie. As far as whether or not he ran into Russell Bufalino and Frank Sheeran that night, I can't say. They did go out looking for Italian food. They did not go out looking for Umberto's. They ended up at Umberto's around 5 a.m. That was the third restaurant they had tried to go to. Every other place was closed, and Umberto's was open late. It was also co-owned by family members of Matty the Horse Ianello, who was a Genovese guy, I think. And when Gallo walked in at 5 a.m. with his whole with his family and his girlfriend and this his bodyguard, Pete the Greek. They walked in, and there was a guy outside, Luparelli, who was a little hanger-on to the Columbos, and he was trying to make his way in. And Luparelli saw him, and he was standing outside, you know, joking and smoking, like you say, with Matty the Horse, who was a capo. And they see Joey Gallo walk in. Joey Gallo didn't see them. So they call up Iacovelli, who was one of the, I think he was the underboss. He was a high up in the Columbos, asked for permission, and he sent a bunch of guys over there. And per Joey Gallo's wife, a bunch of little Italian guys, when I'm balding, shot Joey Gallo. It wasn't a big 6'4", 300-pound Irishman.
Yeah.
It was a bunch of little Italian guys. But I've read other accounts. There was a book I read recently about a guy who said, yeah, I ran into Joey Gallo one night, and he said, oh, it's my birthday. Come with me to go out to Umberto's. We're going to go get some clams. And it's a good thing I didn't go, because that was the night he got killed. So this notion that if you were in the underworld, there's a bunch of guys who were on the fringes of the underworld who claimed to have met with Joey Gallo in the periphery of his death, or I saw him that day right before he died. It's a good thing I didn't hang out with him. You know, whenever there's a big event like that, you're going to have guys trying to make a name for themselves who said, I was right there, man. If I had my gun with me, or if I had been a little closer, so there's always guys who after the fact are going to come in and claim some kind of, you know, because the whole, it's a pissing contest, right, Gary? I mean, you've been front lines. You've been front lines with these guys. They're going to claim everything. I mean, there's 19 guys who claim the Hoffa hit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's just how it is. Everybody wants to be the man, and everybody wants to get that reputation, or at least have some. Even like policemen will do the same thing. There's some deal went down, and everybody that drove by, you know, a few years later, it'll be like they were there, but all they did was drive by, or they happened to be on duty that night. So it's the same kind of a deal. Everybody wants a connection to it, or even like, and I'm not being derogatory about mob fans, but I get so many people who get hold of me and tell me about all these connections they have to the Savella family, and they're related to them, or they're this or that, but their facts are all wrong. So people want to grab some kind of glory or some connection to any kind of those events. So that's just how it is. And the real guys, you know, those that do don't talk.
Yeah, everybody wants to be connected. Yeah, except the guys who actually did it. They don't want to say shit.
Yeah, and Gallo had trouble, you know, that had nothing to do with the Teamsters or with, you know, Bufalino, and you know, I mean, he had internal trouble there with the Columbos, and you know, that they just don't, you know, it just doesn't make sense that they would get a guy like that to do it.
What's interesting is he was also starting his own, as sort of a slap to Joe Colombo, who he had problems with, he was starting his own Italian-American movement. I can't remember the name of it. I could find it. But so as kind of a just sticking it in the ribs of Joe Colombo, Joe Colombo had the Italian-American Civil Rights League.
Yeah.
Joey Gallo had his own Italian-American rights, Italian-Americans of America or something like that. In the movie, you see that Bufalino was upset because what Joey Gallo did was disrespectful to somebody helping Italian-Americans or something like that. And really, Joey Gallo went after Colombo for a different reason, but he had his own pro-Italian-American, just as a little, you know, just a little shot at Colombo, but he was doing his own for the benefit of Italian-Americans, besides, you know, being a mobster and making Italian Americans look like shit to begin with, but
really. Plus, they don't, you know, I mean, so those guys they don't do this stuff unless it's about money.
Mm-hmm. The whole Italian American civil rights thing was a total scam.
Yeah,
it was a total scam. They were just pocketing all the money.
Yeah, everything's about money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that and it collapsed after Colombo because his guys didn't want to run the scam after that. They were pocketing all the money. You had to put one of these stickers in your window, and it was basically a protection racket. And if you were an Italian business that didn't have the sticker in your windows get broken, just like with anything.
Just like the old days, blackhand.
Yeah, exactly. like you said, it was an interesting book. It was a good movie. It did get a little long in the tooth sometimes. My wife and I liked it. I've seen it a couple times because I obviously, if I didn't like that stuff, I wouldn't be helping you out. But I don't know how much credence we can put into Sheeran's claims. Like you said, he was kind of the Forrest Gump of the mob. He did. I mean, you got Hoffa. You've got let's go in order. You've got Lee Harvey Oswald's rifle. Lee Harvey. You've got the Bay of Pigs.
Yeah.
You've got Joey Gallo.
Yeah.
And you've got Jimmy Hoffa.
And Alan
and
Dorfman.
These are Alan Dorfman in there too. So I mean, these are five major events that Sheeran, he just rocked the underworld.
Yeah.
All at the orders of Russell Bufalino, who, while an important guy, you know, we know from Appalachian, I don't know that he had that kind of pull.
Yeah, and I don't know why everybody would come to him with all that. Especially Chicago. I mean, Chicago, they are an entity unto themselves. I have never, ever, and you've studied Chicago as much or more than I have you ever heard of any outside mobster, outside crime family having much to do with Chicago?
No, they do their own, you know, around the Teamsters, everybody has their own little partnerships, but even in that, they're all kind of fighting when, you know, there was some debate, you know, Kansas City pulled for Roy Lee Williams, and there was some fight about that, and then Cleveland was pulling for Jackie Presser, and there was fight about that. Chicago had their own guy, and Detroit had Hoffa for a while until there was fight about that, and then they had Fitch. So it's not like they were all getting along about the Teamsters, even. Even the mobs were fighting amongst themselves. The idea that they were just this friendly group of guys who, you know, you send me your guys. I mean, even within internal mobs, they're all fighting with each other. So they're not just farming out jobs to a random guy because this one, you know, cooperates with this one. I mean, Chicago had plenty of muscle, and if they didn't, you've got plenty of local guys who can do the job.
Really? And you know, they all had a vested interest in getting rid of Hoffa at the end, though. If you think about it, this was during the kind of height of the casino skimming, the casino investment scam. And some people even, I know Teamsters will swear that those were all good investments and they all got their money back. But, you know, it was Kansas City had Roy Williams. Cleveland had Jackie Presser.
Mm-hmm.
Chicago had Alan Dorfman, and Milwaukee had a guy named Frank Rainey, and together they could control the pension fund, International Brotherhood of Teamsters pension fund, which was you know, a $1 billion bank for these guys, and they could get loans. And you know, I've been part of a pension fund on the board, and if the board members decide they want to make a loan or make an investment, they can just do it. There's really no governmental oversight. It's a private deal. I mean, unless
Tony Pro was on the board.
And he was on the board. But Hoffa, when Hoffa wanted to get back in to run the union, he was a wild card, and they could control all these other guys. Frank Fitzsimmons, he was a big old fat dude that wanted to go play golf, and that's all he wanted to do. And Roy Wade Williams, you know, they had him waiting in the wings because they could control Roy Williams. Easily, he was easily controlled by Nick Savella and Jackie Presser. They thought they had him under control. Now, he was a top echelon informant all along, but
his dad was run by Cleveland, and so they had generations of running the Pressers.
So who had control of Hoffa? Nobody had control of Hoffa.
No, Detroit had lost it, and I think that was the ultimate mistake Bobby Kennedy made, is he thought, you lock up Hoffa, you clean up the Teamsters, and really the opposite was true. If Hoffa had been left to his own devices, while he was a crooked guy, he was also the only thing in the Teamsters that was keeping the mob in check at all.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, once you release Hoffa, you've got guys like Dorfman, and even Presser was signing the checks, and, you know, Dorfman and Fitzgerald, I mean, that was just hundreds of millions of dollars sent to Vegas for these loans. And, you know, and even out of Boston, you had a guy named McCarthy, I can't remember, Billy McCarthy maybe, and he was tight with all the groups up there. So, like, I mean, you've got everybody, Tony Pro on the board. I mean, Hoffa was the only guy who was trying to rein it in at all, and I'm not singing his praises. We all know how corrupt he could be, but that was a real... the mob didn't kill him because he was on their side.
Yeah, you know, they were also, at that point in time, they had started in Atlantic City. but they were unable to invest in casinos. They could only get into to the ancillary businesses because they really kept that board tight. But you know, it was just a matter of time before they got somebody in the casino, when they and Tony Pro and Philly and they would in New York and they would New Jersey, they would have wanted that access to that Teamsters money to loan to their own casino straw men and get a casino that they basically owned and could get that skim started. So it was just, you know, Hoffa was, he was a fly in the ointment, and you know they had that planned and plus the other plan out west. So everybody had a vested interest in keeping Hoffa out because he was so hard to control. But it's Detroit's problem. I know how these guys work.
Good point.
If it's a certain family's problem, if it's a certain person's problem, it's your problem. Like Tony Spilotro, they told him out in Las Vegas after all the hole in the wall and Frank Gallardo, and they got caught, and there was things were kind of collapsing out in Las Vegas. And they said, you know, they told Tony, you got to clean your laundry up out there. You got to wash your clothes out there, some words to that effect. And when Culotta found out about that, he knew. See, it was Tony's job to clean up some mess in Las Vegas. It's like it would be Kansas City's job to clean up some mess in Kansas City. And it would have been Detroit's job, which makes sense Tony Jack was involved in this, and that's, you know, that's factual. Now, I think this Frank Sheerhan, he probably had enough sources that he knows what happened. Mm-hmm. I think he just inserted himself in. Well, I'm curious what you think as maybe as a layperson and a historian and a guy that's looked at him all across the board about having Chucky O'Brien, his adopted son, be the driver. I've got my own theory on that, but what do you think, Cam?
You know, I think, and Chucky O'Brien's stepson has been a guy named, I think his name is Goldberg. He's a professor at Harvard. He's been writing a bunch of books and saying that he's not happy about this movie because it's retrying Huffy, Chucky O'Brien in the public eye. Right? that was his mob name.
Huffy. Moving right along.
They're retrying him in the public eye. It's hard to say. Chucky always maintained his innocence, and I think that with as much as went into the investigation, and the FBI, from everything I've seen, they think that Sal Bergoglio did it.
Yeah.
And if Chucky had any real part in it, I think that the FBI would have really come down on him instead of, you know, a few months for this, that, or the other. And it definitely ruined Chucky's life, and I don't know that he was at the point where the mob would have involved him even accidentally. I don't know that they would take that kind of a chance with a guy saying, "Hey, could you go pick up your stepfather and bring him somewhere?" I don't know much about Chucky, except that I do believe that the mob would not take that kind of a chance. Just like how Bufalino is driving to Detroit. Now, we know that they were going to Detroit, but I don't think that a mob boss as high up as Bufalino would allow himself to be an alibi in something like the Hoffa murder.
Right, that close to
Right, and I just don't know that the mob would take such a risk, because if Chucky were to break and say, "Well, yeah, I talked to this guy who told me to go here and there," and I mean, it would just be too easy to trace that back, I think, and they never did trace it back through Chucky. I think that the FBI had a little bit of egg on their face about that whole Hoffa thing, and so they gave him a few months for something. But you'd probably know more about it than I. But I don't know that Chucky had much to do with it.
Yeah.
If anything,
and I of course don't have any personal experience with Chucky O'Brien, there's no history that I know of about like Jimmy Hoffa being an abusive father, for example, or Chucky O'Brien being really jealous and he feels like he's not getting what he should. And I don't know of any history like that. He had to have, you know, what kind of motive would he have?
Yeah.
And I guess, suppose, you know, in theory, the mob could come to him and they could dupe him into doing that and saying, "Hey, you know, we want you to pick up your dad and we want you to drive this guy and pick up your pick up Jimmy at this restaurant and take him over for this meet, and then you need to go on, then come back and we call you and pick him up, and then they never call him and he comes back. But I don't know. It just,
it's a hell of a risk.
Yeah, that's a hell of a risk. They don't know whether Chucky, I mean, Chucky's, you know, be a huge emotional burden for him to bear. I mean, that would just be unbearable. I would think that he would eventually, you know, crack, or he'd do self-sabotaging behavior where he'd get himself in trouble and then talk. There are just a lot of different psychological reasons why that would be stupid to do that. Now, having said all that, they did need somebody who would put Hoffa at ease, I would think. Hoffa didn't fall off the turnip truck yesterday.
That's true.
I don't know whether that Sal Brulio could put him at ease. Now, Chucky O'Brien could have put him at ease. He could have said, you know, they won't do anything to me because, you know, they got Chucky's out here as a witness. He's not going in this house, but we don't want him going. I don't want him going in this house and hearing these conversations. Yeah. Now, I can see where that there's some credence to that from that viewpoint, but it's a hell of a risk.
And it could be, I don't know that Hoffa would have trusted Tony Jack to that point. I mean, that would be awful foolish because, you know, and in the movie, we see that Hoffa doesn't really know Tony Jack that well. Yeah. He just sort of, and of course, we know Tony Jack was Hoffa's guy. He was the guy that sort of brought Hoffa into the mob. Tony Jack was a really important guy. And in the movie, he's sort of a periphery character who's sort of a hanger on to Tony, Provenzano, which is not true at all. They were related through marriage, but
Tony Jack maybe could get him to do that under the guise that, you know, we're going to make peace and we're going to
have a sit down.
We're going to sit down. We're going to help you get back in now, but we got to talk about how this is going to shake out.
But Tony Jack was seen at a health the day of the murder. Tony Jack was at a health club. He was shaking hands with everybody. Oh, you know, usually he was kind of a standoffish guy, I guess, and he was shaking hands with everybody. Hey, how you doing? It's good to see you. So everybody at this health club saw and shook hands with Tony Jack. So it goes. So if Tony Jack wasn't there and Tony Pro was in New Jersey, There's every chance that nobody knows about Alva, and it sure could be that Frank Sheeran did it. But I mean, there are guys that Frank Sheeran was committing crimes with back in the day, and these are recordings that took place in the 70s where Frank Sheeran says on recording two guys that he was robbing with, that he was committing crimes with. He was like, oh, I wasn't even there until the 31st. I wasn't even in Detroit for that wedding until the 31st. And these are guys that he was robbing with and likely wouldn't. I mean, he was drunk. I mean, there's, you know, when you're drunk and you're around, you know, your co-criminals, that's when guys start telling tales.
Yeah.
If he was gonna say anything, he probably would have. The FBI doesn't believe Sheeran had anything to do with it. Now, Dan Moldia, who was the big Hoffa researcher, he thinks Sheeran was involved somehow. But somebody got Hoffa into the car. If it was Chucky O'Brien, it could have been. It really could have been the FBI around the 1990s. Started saying that Chucky didn't have anything to do with it. I have read that, and he would have trusted Sheeran, that's true. Sheeran, until that book came out, Sheeran always said he was not in Detroit at that time. And then Sheeran said that Hoffa had written him a letter or something, and that turned out to be a fake that Sheeran had written himself. I know several publishers turned it down because factually it just wasn't there. I know that he was supposed to go on Dateline or 60 Minutes, and they refused to let him on because it just sounded like nonsense. And I know that the FBI watched a video of Sheeran confessing, and they thought it was ridiculous. So, and I know that Brandt was an interrogator, and he said he interrogated Sheeran for months before Sheeran finally confessed to having done it. Now, Sheeran is in his 80s. He's got bad arthritis and a foot problem, and you've got this writer sitting promising you a book deal and promising you that you can support your family, that maybe you haven't done a good job, and for months and months and months telling you, come on, tell me, come on, tell me, come on, tell me. Maybe that would lead you to make a false confession. Maybe it wouldn't. I don't know.
Yeah, or lead you to, as you laid out the framework of how these book deals work and how, you know, you market that thing and what would make it more marketable and make it really hit. And, and you know, sure, and he may or may not know this, but you and I know if you could have something like that on your cover, you know, interview with the man that killed Jimmy Hoffa, you know, that's gold, man. That thing shoots and you know, you end up, and then they end up with a movie deal. So it's, you know, Sharon, and he would have seen that and figured that out.
And I'll say this, there's been a bunch of evidence added in the addendums to that book. They've added 25, 30 pages of evidence that proves these claims are true, that you know, to back up all the claims. The problem I have with that is when you set out to prove something is true, and you, as law enforcement, you can probably speak to this. When you get that kind of confirmation bias, like you don't, it's like with science. Scientists don't step out to prove a theory. They try and test a theory. So if this Charles Brandt and his publishers already believe something to be true, they're going to find every piece of evidence or data or interview or anything that proves that it's true, rather than trying to test to see if it's true. And you know, I think you've probably seen a lot of guys who get caught up in that. If you believe that somebody did something, and you can go down that rabbit hole, and you can overlook evidence to the contrary because you're focused on one guy. I know that I've talked to other guys who were law enforcement, and they've seen guys go down that rabbit hole, and I know that the FBI has done that kind of thing, and they've excluded other people, you know, and Bobby Kennedy did it with Hoffa. He figured he went only for Hoffa, and he ignored the rest of the corruption, and it turned out he was wrong. So I think that this Brandt has tried to focus on only Sheeran and find evidence that only supports that Sheeran did it, and that confirmation bias has probably gone into that book quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. I used to notice that when you had an idea on a case, a whodunit kind of a case, and all of a sudden everything just seemed to be almost there, but it led you on down that path, but it was almost there. And it was almost there, and it was almost there. And then all of a sudden, in the end, it just fritters away. But the ones that you solve, and you're for sure you got the right person, they like, you know, you don't have that little stream of things. You all of a sudden have something that you know. You think, that's it. I know this is it. Then you may build around that. But when it's just those little things that come right after you think you know who did it, that almost are there, but not quite. And they'll lead you right down the path, man.
That's interesting.
And you'll never find the one that really locks it in. Now
that's interesting.
That's what happens is sometimes somebody will get a wrongful conviction because you build up enough these little coincidences that, you know, you can get something going. But, you know, when you got the guy, there's no doubt about it. There's no doubt in your mind there is some smoking gun there that there's some kind of smoking gun, and there was no smoking gun in this one. It was all supposition.
That's a good phrase. Yeah, that's a good way to put it, Gary. You're right.
So anyhow, it was a good movie, like you said. Like I told you guys, we're going to do a little speculation here. In my opinion, it would have been a much better series, like a limited 4 or 5 part series, and really go into Dorfman and why, what was he doing? I mean, the movie just glossed over him. You know, he went up and tried to kill the dude. You know, what was he doing? Why did they try to kill him? What's going on there? The whole JFK thing, if they wanted to deal with that, then they should have, included Carlos Marcello in there and Traficante and some of the other things, and, you know, getting guns for the Bay of Pigs and for the Cubans. There's a whole bunch of different facts that you can have a whole hour show just on that one right there, and the mob involved in that. And they did have some involvement, and you know, that, and Giancana and Johnny Roselli
and Traficante,
and there's a lot of information out there in those JFK files about all that stuff, and mm-hmm. when we tell parole, there's a lot of information about that that you could easily build a whole episode just around that, a whole episode around Alan Dorfman, as you know, what's the deal here, and a whole episode around Joey Gallo, and it'd been a really interesting show. More interesting if you'd have developed each one of those incidents. And of course, the problem with developing each one of those incidents, you might have really stretched the believability to then put him in it when you really developed him out. Sort of just makes it totally fictional.
But to get all those guys together, you had Harvey Keitel as Angelo Bruno, yeah, and you had Pacino. Jack Nicholson did Hoffa in 92, and he did a hell of a Hoffa. Yeah. Pacino, it was all right, but they did that interesting with the computer technology making him look younger, but you're still watching this 70-year-old guy whose face might look 35, but, a 75-year-old guy moves differently from a 35-year-old guy.
Did you notice that? I had somebody else point that out, and I noticed it, that Robert De Niro particularly, I thought, he moved kind of awkwardly. I don't know, stiffly. I don't know if...
But he's 76 years old, I think that...
That's probably the way he moves. I move kind of stiffly myself, but when he's playing Sharon as a young man, he's still moving the same.
I think that's just his body.
And of course, Pacino.
Well, they corrected Pacino on that. They said that you're supposed to be 40 years old when you stand up. He said you're supposed to be standing up like you're 45. And Pacino said, "Oh, and am I doing like I'm 46?" And they kind of laughed about it. Yeah. But they said they had to work on that jumping up and taking two steps at once and things that they would have done as young men.
And especially Hoffa. Hoffa was a fireplug, man.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever seen any of those videos of him, I posted a couple recently. He was on the Dick Cavett Show. He didn't creak and crow around. He was a real vital guy and real energetic. And so, he used to, I remember as a kid, everybody, when I was a kid, everybody knew the name Hoffa.
That's another thing. Anybody under 50 might not know about this movie, but Hoffa was, Hoffa's bigger than the president.
Oh, man, he was. He truly was. And, the Teamsters, they could pretty well elect a president. I mean, after all, Richard Nixon pardoned him, thinking, next time around for the Republican Party, Hoffa will be, he's back in and he's going to get all his votes to vote Republican.
Well, Presser backed Reagan.
Which they thought was
very strange, but he definitely supported him.
Well, the other Republican pardoned Hoffa, so...
Yep.
And plus, the Republicans, by that point in time, they'd figured out how to divide the Union people, how to pull them away from the Democrats by doing that war and anti-war thing in the 70s and sowing fear in the hearts of all those working guys. It's like what's going on today in a way. And so getting them to vote against their own interest, heck, for a Union guy to vote for Ronald Reagan for president, what sense does that make? Huh?
Ronald Reagan, on paper, he
busted the unions. It was under Reagan that unions lost so much power. He started off with busting the air traffic controllers union. He busted that union, and they vote for Ronald Reagan. And a union, I've been in a union. You'll vote like your union tells you to vote. They'll get the word around how they want you to vote, and if you're a good union guy, that's how you vote.
That was how Chicago used to control the elections. You get out to the unions and you get, it was one of the ways. Chicago had a lot of ways to control elections.
Yeah.
But the unions were one way.
Yeah. But it's a huge political power, not only getting the money out of the pension.
It was, yeah.
Access to the money, but that's a big source of power. But to control the vote and sell that to politicians, that's, it's amazing. All right, so I think we've done this. I think we've ran the Irishman into the ground, Cam. But it was a good movie.
I will watch again,
especially since it's on Netflix. I probably wouldn't go in the theater again, but I'll watch it again on Netflix. I just haven't found the free 3 hours or so, 3.5 hours. You must have too much free time on your hands. You've seen it twice.
I was on vacation last week.
Oh, that's right. That's right. You were at relative's house, so you needed something to occupy yourself with.
I need to watch a few films about people killing each other.
There you go. All right. So, folks, if you have a friend or relative has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. And don't forget, I have a new movie out. As you all know by now, go to Amazon Prime. You know, you can buy it if you want the DVD, and I've got some raw interviews as my special features on that. But and it helps me out a lot more. You help the podcast out a lot more if you buy it off my website. But I appreciate all the support that all you guys give me out there and continue to give me. We break even at least every year, which is, you can't ask for more than that. And it can't all have all this fun too, right, Cam?
That's right. That's right, man.
I got my book, Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. Get the Kindle version because I attached a whole lot of the actual wiretaps to the Kindle version. And you can go right online from your iPad while you're reading and listen to the actual wiretaps at the Kansas City Mob Tour app.
You know, that's just damned unique. Yeah, that's just real unique to you.
Not many others out there like that. Somebody told me, said, you got digitally, you've got the Kansas City Mob covered.
That's right.
Surprised they haven't gone after me. I have had some attacks on my website in the past, but they seem to be over for now, knock on wood, cross my fingers. But, you know, and I had a guy get hold of me, and he said, you guys don't know what you're talking about. Some anonymous party through email. And he's talking about, and he acts like he's from Kansas City. He said, what about all these Italian guys that have these real nice houses and don't have any means of income? And I know they're doing they're doing internet scams. And so I don't know. They probably are. I just was researching a guy in New York City that was involved in a phone cramming scheme where they were, you remember they used to have those numbers that you could call, and you once you called that number, then it would throw a big charge on your bill.
Yeah.
They get you to call that number, or they had other scams through this one company. I think that's what they call cramming, but they had other scams through a company and a porn site where they'd get your phone number and they could start inserting just small amounts of money on a credit card or a phone bill. And mm-hmm. people won't even notice it, you know, like $4 or $5. I have to go through mine every once in a while, my credit card bill, and say, well, what is that $15 for? Now, I always found what it's for, but now, you know, some other, like an app, like the CBS app. I like getting CBS, so it's $5.99 a month. I forget, you know, that I've done it. And
these fees creep up.
Oh, you know, yeah, they do. I imagine everybody out there can relate to that. You got about 4 or 5 different little things on your credit card that come in every month. You can't really remember what they're for. I had an insurance policy that I got. It's an accidental life and death that I got. I think it's $100,000 after I left the police department, because I go out and ride that motorcycle and I do, you know, I do some slightly risky things. And I thought, well, you know, I ought to just go ahead and get that and make my wife because it isn't very much for accidental death and dismemberment. But I forget that's what it's for. And there's no, doesn't really say what it's for. It's like $35 every 3 months or something like that. And I, you know, it's like, well, what is this $35 for? I even called the police department, my pension part of it, and ask them, what the hell is that for? And they said, oh, that's that accidental death insurance that you got. So, you know, moving right along, I think that's all we got on this, don't you, Cam? You got anything else?
Yeah, I think so. No, we did it in under 3.5 hours, too.
Yeah. All right, Cam, good night.
Good to see you, Gary.
Good night, Wiretappers.
Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.